Chapter 2. Creed. A secular religion? In February 2020, I was invited onto the BBC's The Big Questions to debate the topic, Is Wokeness the New Religion? I had already anticipated that mine would be the unfashionable view, and so I steeled myself in advance for the inevitable onslaught. This being a British daytime television show, the onslaught took the form of audible grumbles and a few raised eyebrows. One of my fellow panellists expressed her dismay that we were discussing this topic at all, which is akin to accepting an invitation to a birthday party and then complaining about the bunting. Finding myself drawn into the whataboutery, I agreed that I would much rather be delving into other matters, economic inequality perhaps, or the life and work of Nana Mouskouri, but given that the subject matter had been set in advance, it seemed churlish to grumble now. Another panellist, some breed of activist whose whole body appeared to be stuttering with anger, spat out a few of the usual accusations. Didn't I understand how important it was to oppose racism? And wasn't I simply profiting from a culture war that I was deliberately helping to stoke? Well, yes and no, in that order. Apparently, this twitching fellow had written a book on anti-racism and had received threats following its publication. When I pointed out that I too had been threatened online, his immediate retort was, "Good." As the audience collectively squirmed, evidently unprepared for what happens when the good guy turns bad, he attempted to backpedal by suggesting that our common experience might facilitate further dialogue. It was too late. His instinct had betrayed him. Not that he was entirely to blame. Those of us who have taken a critical stance on the culture war in the hope of hastening its demise have often been misinterpreted as attempting to prolong it. For a considerable period of time, most people were happy to dismiss such matters as the niche obsessions of trolls prowling the dark recesses of the internet, or overzealous students hankering after a cause. In the green days before the coronavirus lockdowns, it was tempting for commentators to hold fast to the received wisdom that the culture war was merely a distraction advanced by unscrupulous politicians. My appearance on The Big Questions took place a month before the global chain reaction of coronavirus lockdowns, and 3 months before the death of George Floyd and the subsequent protests. Were the debate to be replayed today, it is unlikely that my perspective would be deemed marginal. Few would now deny that the culture war has exploded into the mainstream, and all of us are implicated, whether we like it or not. The question of whether or not wokeness is the new religion is unlikely to feature as a topic for debate these days. For all its flaws, the analogy is now commonplace, and many pundits speak freely of the religion of social justice without any need for further qualification. Culture warriors of all stripes have become increasingly doctrinaire and sectarian. Many of them favour slogans as a substitute for thought, almost as a form of holy writ. They have their own esoteric language, originating in largely outdated postmodernist jargon, and enshrined in foundational sacred texts by the likes of thinkers such as Michel Foucault and Judith Butler, or the intersectional theories popularised by Kimberly Crenshaw. And although heretics are unlikely to be burned at the stake, their inquisitors are convinced that non-believers must convert for their own good. All of this amounts to the legitimization of bullying on a grand scale. American physicist Steven Weinberg famously remarked that with or without religion, good people can behave well and bad people can do evil, but for good people to do evil, that takes religion. When the Puritans descended on churches across the United Kingdom in the mid-17th century, destroying paintings, statues, stained glass, and any other images deemed offensive to their creed, they were not necessarily doing so out of a juvenile relish for vandalism. Many believed that they were undertaking God's work, and that their values should be imposed on the populace for its own sake. So too our latter-day Puritans, who are happy to demolish the problematic monuments of the past and scour social media for prey like so many vultures circling their barely breathing lunch. They are the clergy for the digital age, an elite class that claims to know what is best for the unlettered plebeians. The trouble with all such righteous causes is that they attract the bullies who seek an approved outlet for their baser instincts. Some don the sacerdotal robes out of a sense of duty, others as a disguise. Social media is the playground turned battlefield for these online crusaders. Here they pontificate to the masses, berate those who fall short of their moral expectations, and endlessly trawl through old tweets or Facebook posts in the hope of discovering a misjudged phrase or sentiment that could justify a campaign of public shaming. In their eyes, there is no possibility of redemption. The most vicious remarks you will find on social media come from the racist far right and intersectional activists. They are two faces of the same chimera. Identitarians on the right and left have an interdependent relationship. Each one nourishes and sustains the other. That is not to suggest some kind of moral equivalence. One of the most tragic aspects of this movement is that many of its acolytes are well-meaning. Yet unlike the culture warriors of the far right, who are universally despised in civilized society, the woke religionists have positioned themselves as being on the right side of history, and therefore enjoy major institutional support. In spite of being capable of the most horrendous dehumanizing behavior, many of them believe themselves to be the good guys. With this paradox in mind, the prospect of putting an end to the culture war seems Sisyphean. How does one tackle a bully who bullies others in the name of love? These cultural revolutionaries are engaged in an ongoing collective effort to destabilize and reorganize society around their ideological principles, underpinned by the conviction that the powerful, defined solely by group identity, are unaware of the structures that they unwittingly perpetuate. In this battle, however, the chief antagonists consider themselves to be under siege. In this perverse formulation, the defense of liberal principles is taken as an attack. This is why those who object to these radical and divisive societal upheavals are so often accused of starting a culture war when they are simply responding to it. The New Puritans are brawlers with a persecution complex, wildly throwing punches at strangers and then blaming them for the bloodstains on their hands. We hardly even know what to call the movement, because this culture war is largely being waged through the subtle, and sometimes not so subtle, redefinition of language. The New Puritans have become adept at the reapplication of existing terms that deviate from their widely accepted meanings. Phrases such as social justice, anti-racism, liberalism, equity, whiteness, violence, safety, and endless others now bear connotations that are understood only by a minority of activists. They have apparently taken their cues from Humpty Dumpty in Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, 1871. "When I use a word," he says to Alice, "it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." When most of us say social justice, we mean the concept of equality under the law, opposition to prejudice and discrimination, and equal opportunities for all. When social justice activists say social justice, they mean an emphasis on group identity over the rights of the individual, a rejection of social liberalism, and the assumption that unequal outcomes are always evidence of structural inequalities. When most of us say that we are anti-racist, we mean that we are opposed to racism. When anti-racists say they are anti-racist, they mean they are in favour of a rehabilitated form of racial thinking that makes judgments first and foremost on the basis of skin colour and on the unsubstantiated supposition that our entire society and all human interactions are undergirded by white supremacy. No wonder most of us are so confused. For the logomachists of the New Puritanism, the ambiguity is the point. Where there are no shared definitions, there can be no possibility of discussion. This strategy of destabilizing language and its meaning enables the well-versed to befuddle the layman with jargon, thereby giving vacuous theories the impression of substance. Moreover, the ambiguity can act as a get-out clause to make statements that are otherwise bound to be interpreted as hostile. This is why Cambridge academic Priyamvada Gopal can write phrases such as abolish whiteness and white lives don't matter as white lives, and then blame those who are offended for being insufficiently schooled. That is not to suggest that she is insincere in her views, but one can appreciate from this example how such buzzwords can be readily exploited by those with an agenda. So it has come to this. Liberalism is akin to Nazism. Words are violence. Debate is a fetish. We have somehow found ourselves in this mystifying scenario in which self-declared liberals are advancing an illiberal agenda, leftists are failing to stand up for left-wing ideals, social justice means the opposite of what it says, and anti-racists are creating a more racist society. The old definitions no longer apply. Culture warriors of all political affiliations play high-stakes word games, and truth and rationality are the casualties. We are dealing with a rapidly developing religion, albeit one of the secular kind, whose abstruse language and peculiar rituals are as incomprehensible to us as the miracle of transubstantiation must have been to a medieval congregation. This is a contemporary form of hocus pocus. We are tasting wine while the clergy assures us it is blood. Repent, motherfucker! Some of the more zealous activists of the Cultural Revolution have developed a liking for explicitly religious phraseology. After the comedian Dave Chappelle's show, The Closer, was aired on Netflix in October 2021, there was a backlash among staff who staged a protest outside the company's headquarters in Los Gatos, California. Counter-protesters gathered to champion Chappelle's right to freedom of expression. In footage from the event, the comedian Vito Gesualdi can be seen holding a placard bearing the words, "We like Dave." One protester seizes the placard and tears it apart, leaving Gesualdi holding just a stick. Incredibly, Gesualdi's assailant then accuses him of carrying a weapon. The most telling moment comes when a woman approaches Gesualdi and repeatedly screams in his face, "Repent, motherfucker!" I can think of no more apposite phrase to encapsulate the combination of rage and religiosity that characterizes this movement. By making jokes about gender identity, Chappelle had committed the sin of heresy. Not only had he acknowledged the inescapable truth of biological sex differences and raised questions about the notion of gender self-identification, he had further exposed the priggishness and hypocrisy of those who claim to be on the side of the angels. But perhaps the most salient aspect of this affair was when Ted Sarandos, a co-CEO at Netflix, reneged on his defence of artistic freedom. He had inflamed tensions by initially standing by his decision to broadcast Chappelle's show. "While some employees disagree," he said, "we have a strong belief that content on screen doesn't directly translate to real-world harm." This was in stark contrast to the claim of the protesters. To take a prominent example, the writer and producer Jacqueline Moore declared that she would no longer work with Netflix because of Chappelle's dangerous transphobic content. While Sarandos had called into question the possibility that jokes could result in violence, Moore had asserted it to be the case. Under pressure from activists, Sarandos apologised for his original statement. In an interview with Variety, he said that he had screwed up and claimed that, of course, storytelling has real impact in the real world. The power of these new Puritans is such that even a top executive will intone the required liturgical cant at their behest. This necessitates a rejection of reality and evidence-based reasoning in favour of lived experience, a point to which we will later return. A key aspect of Sarandos's mea culpa was his failure to sufficiently acknowledge the pain and hurt of his employees. In an extraordinary reversal of corporate hierarchy, the boss had become the victim of a struggle session orchestrated by his subordinates. One of my key concerns in this book is the relationship between language and power, and how supposedly progressive activists have accepted as an article of faith the notion that words can be forms of violence. There appears to be a particular emphasis on the way in which popular culture has the capacity to corrupt the masses, despite all evidence that this correlation is unsound. After more than 6 decades of research into media effects theories, the hypothesis of a malleable public who act on cue from the mass media they consume has been roundly discredited. So why is it that the view that jokes can be dangerous is now so widely shared? In so many of these cases, we are seeing a paradoxical process by which victimhood is transformed into a source of power. This is why, in his book Dominion, 2019, Tom Holland is able to trace a direct link from the Christian theology of the past to the new ideology of social justice. Through his suffering and martyrdom, Jesus Christ became the supreme paragon of triumph through persecution. So while faith in Christ has receded, Holland argues, the values of Christianity have been retained in the culture wars of the present. Christianity, it seemed, had no need of actual Christians for its assumptions still to flourish. Whether this was an illusion, or whether the power held by victims over their victimizers would survive the myth that had given it birth, only time would tell. As it was, the retreat of Christian belief did not seem to imply any necessary retreat of Christian values, quite the contrary. Even in Europe, a continent with churches far emptier than those in the United States, the trace elements of Christianity continued to infuse people's morals and presumptions so utterly that many failed even to detect their presence. Even as the influence of Christianity declines, its tenets are subsumed into a new religion, secular but equally dogmatic. As Holland puts it, most of us in the West, even those opposed to Christianity, are but goldfish swimming in Christian waters. The author and cultural critic James Lindsay takes this a step further, making the case that the woke ideology fulfills the definition of a religion in the most literal sense, and should be safeguarded as such under the First Amendment. By extension, he argues, citizens need to be protected from the obligation to adhere to its guiding principles in both their private lives and in the workplace. In other words, he is making a case for the separation of wokeness and the state. Lindsay opens his essay with a quotation from Ben Clements in the Cornell Law Review, defining religion as a comprehensive belief system that addresses the fundamental questions of human existence, such as the meaning of life and death, man's role in the universe, and the nature of good and evil, and that gives rise to duties of conscience. If a non-supernatural belief system such as Confucianism can be considered a religion, advancing as it does a humanistic philosophy that perceives the secular as sacred, then why not social justice? Recent books such as John McWhorter's Woke Racism, 2021, and Vivek Ramaswamy's Woke Inc., 2021, also argue that this ideology is a religion in an authentic rather than merely analogous sense. But is social justice the most accurate phrase? It is the term that the New Puritans applied to themselves, but they have sound strategic motivations for doing so. One of the reasons why this ideology has been so successful in its infiltration of major institutions has been due to the appealing language it adopts. Few would claim to be against social justice, and so to oppose the movement feels counterintuitive for the majority of decent people. It is a Trojan horse term by which bad ideas are smuggled into popular discourse. As early as 1956, Charles Curran, in the pages of The Spectator, was dismissing the term as a noble bromide and a semantic fraud from the same stable as people's democracy. The economist and philosopher Friedrich von Hayek devoted a substantial proportion of the second volume of his Law, Legislation and Liberty, 1976, to what he called the mirage of social justice. In it, he argues that it is a hollow incantation, and that the people who habitually employ the phrase simply do not know themselves what they mean by it, and just use it as an assertion that a claim is justified without giving a reason for it. He continues, "It is not pleasant to have to argue against a superstition which is held most strongly by men and women who are often regarded as the best in our society, and against a belief that has become almost the new religion of our time, and in which many of the ministers of old religion have found their refuge, and which has become the recognized mark of the good man. But the present universality of that belief proves no more the reality of its object than did the universal belief in witches or the philosopher's stone." The term social justice, Hayek maintains, is the prime example of how fine sentiments risk becoming the instruments for the destruction of all values of a free civilization. It would seem that little has changed in the intervening five decades. A present-day example of this kind of linguistic prestidigitation is evinced by activists who organise under the banner of Antifa, a contraction of anti-fascist, who are thereby able to engage in violence and intimidation against political opponents and simultaneously evade accusations of fascistic tactics. Like Black Lives Matter, these groups rely on the good nature of a public who are likely to interpret their name literally. After all, only a fascist would complain about anti-fascism. One prominent political correspondent fell for this basic rhetorical trick when she described the Normandy landing of more than 150,000 Allied troops as the biggest Antifa rally in history. Activist singer Billy Bragg posted an image of Winston Churchill, captioned simply with "Antifa." These are the kinds of simplistic misunderstandings that such word games are always apt to engender. Likewise, even as we criticise adherents to the social justice ideology, we inadvertently support their cause by adopting their preferred branding. To return to Curran's point, the notion that self-styled social justice activists are advancing social justice in any meaningful sense is akin to believing that the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is an authentic democracy. In their book Cynical Theories, How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender and Identity and Why This Harms Everybody, 2020, Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay favour a capitalised form of social justice to distinguish the ideology from the principle. Yet this only gets us so far. More recently, the authors have generally used the term critical social justice, which adds a handy qualifier in order to make this key distinction, one that invokes the critical theory upon which the movement is based. This is especially germane given that the term originates from the theorists themselves. In Is Everyone Really Equal? 2017, Özlem Sensoy and Robin DiAngelo emphasise that the mainstream understanding of social justice as related to fairness and equality is not the aim of their movement. This, after all, would be a liberal humanist approach, one that the woke ideology explicitly seeks to undermine. Rather, a critical approach to social justice refers to specific theoretical perspectives that recognise that society is stratified, i.e. divided and unequal, in significant and far-reaching ways along social group lines that include race, class, gender, sexuality and ability. Critical social justice, therefore, recognises inequality as deeply embedded in the fabric of society, i.e. as structural, and actively seeks to change this. Given that there is a marked disparity between what most people understand by social justice and what activists and academics mean when they use the term, we would do well to adopt Pluckrose's distinction of critical social justice and liberal social justice. The latter is the belief that inequalities and injustices in society are best addressed through civil discourse, the free exchange of views, and evidence-based analysis. The former is the belief that society is irredeemably unequal and unjust, that these structures are maintained by oppressive groups wielding power over the oppressed, that these groups are defined in terms of identity, i.e. race, gender, sexuality, and that the solution lies in the forcible reconfiguration of language, history and social norms. Now that the culture war has reached the mainstream, it remains to be seen whether this distinction between critical social justice and liberal social justice will have any utility when it comes to communicating the problem to a general audience. Most people understand and have experienced the rise of this new movement, can see that it is authoritarian and regressive in nature, but are baffled because it describes itself in liberal and progressive terms. In recent years, a solution has presented itself in the form of the concept of being woke, which has become a kind of shorthand for this sprawling and complex ideology. But, as we shall see, even this appellation has become compromised by endless reinterpretation. The view that critical social justice is tantamount to a religion is certainly persuasive. Consider the way in which its ideas have infected the private and public sector, with workers expected to pay lip service to a doctrine they are unlikely to share. The religion of critical social justice is probably the most accessible and immediate analogy to capture the nature of this ideology and how it operates. This is not to be taken as a slight against religion in toto, but rather an acknowledgement that the theories that underpin the critical social justice movement are essentially faith-based. There are all sorts of examples of how we have been urged to take on trust a variety of extraordinary claims. Practitioners of fat studies maintain that there are no authentic health risks to obesity, and that the seemingly irrefutable evidence to the contrary is the product of the inherent bigotry of the scientific method. An image of an individual with a blood-stained crotch is shared online to prove that men can menstruate, when we can all quite clearly see that this is a biological female who identifies as male. According to the New Puritans, the observable realities of existence are a mirage. Only they have access to the truth, and we are all invited to jettison verifiable facts and nod along. Is this really any different from a preacher who insists that his supernatural interpretation of the world must be uncritically accepted without any evidence to support it? Unlike most religions, critical social justice does not encourage the kind of self-reflection that allows us to acknowledge our own faults. Rather, it promotes an unshakable sense of certainty in one's own convictions and a complete intolerance of non-believers. In truth, it more closely resembles a fundamentalist religion, insofar as it demands a belief in the unfalsifiable at pain of excommunication, but for the sake of concision, the word religion will suffice. We might even be tempted to take the analogy a step further and see in the events of 2020 a transition to the status of religion from what was formerly a cult. When I made the case for the religiosity of wokeness on The Big Questions back in February of that year, many were left unpersuaded, given that the cultural capital of its preeminent disciples was not at that time widely appreciated. As the year went on, however, we found ourselves reluctantly crossing the Rubicon, with the martinets of critical social justice distributing the wading boots. There is little doubt that these cultural cattle prodders now wield an undue degree of power and influence in all areas of public life. Minority rule. I have been thinking and writing about these issues for many years, but I'm doing so now in a changed world, one in which the evidence of my claims is everywhere, and the imputation of an imaginary culture war is no longer entertained by serious people. It is my hope that, following the events of 2020, readers will be more receptive to a position that for so long was dismissed as needlessly alarmist. Ideas that once lurked at the penumbra of public consciousness have become the main attraction. The bullying and infantile tactics of the New Puritans can often lead people to dismiss them outright as crackpots and mountebanks. This is a mistake, because the ideology that they represent is now a dominant and destructive force in our society. While we may chuckle at their sheer irrationality and pearl-clutching moralism, we are at risk of overlooking the threat that they pose to the ideals of a liberal democracy. It hardly helps that many of those in positions of power have blindly accepted the tenets of this new religion without understanding its grave implications. Although culturally and politically powerful, the New Puritans have always been in the minority. A recent report by the More in Common initiative estimates that they represent a mere 13% of the population. They have been indulged largely because of their intimidatory tactics. Crucially, the narrative of straightforward generational differences are not reflected in the data. The New Puritans are a minority in all generations. And so to reframe this as a matter of older people failing to adjust to changing norms is entirely misleading. Some of the most vehement pushback against this ideology is coming from Generation Z, those born between 1997 and 2012. Naturally, young people are more likely to endorse high-status opinions. With their career prospects yet to be determined, they have more to lose by challenging the status quo. The teenage years seem to engender the contradictory instincts of conformity and rebellion. The religion of critical social justice offers a solution, enabling conformity under the guise of rebellion. Yet it is striking that so many young adults remain sceptical about this ideology, for all its fashionable cheerleaders. I have written elsewhere about how the tendency to dismiss the younger generation as snowflakes is both counterproductive and inaccurate. My various experiences of speaking on university campuses is that students are, by and large, eager to be challenged and open to hearing views that they have been assured, usually by academics of my generation, are beyond the pale. When I delivered a presentation to the International Politics Society at Aberystwyth University, it was the older members of staff who refused to publicise the event on the grounds that a talk likely to be antagonistic to woke culture would violate their departmental ethos of promoting diversity. It would seem that diversity of opinion is not their priority. The truest commitment to diversity, of course, involves a recognition of the primacy and sovereignty of the individual. To borrow a metaphor from C.S. Lewis, the symphony of the world would be insufferably bland if all the instruments in the orchestra played the same note. Such concerns are trifling to the breed of academic that prioritizes activism over research. I find it endlessly surprising that some of the most truculent and juvenile online behaviour I have witnessed has come from teaching staff in higher education, but such is the constitution of the New Puritans. As Helen Pluckrose pointed out to me, it's a worry when you can't tell whether the person yelling at you is a 12-year-old whose parents need to take their Twitter account away, or a professor of sociology. This is not to suggest that there is not a problem with resilience among students, but as broadcaster and free speech campaigner Claire Fox has outlined in her book I Find That Offensive, 2016, this is largely a product of overprotective teaching and parenting strategies by older generations, as well as an approach to anti-bullying that has encouraged young people to believe that trauma is inevitable and permanent. In a principled effort to shield children from harm, we have put them at greater risk by promoting the idea that to be challenged is a form of emotional abuse. That a culture of offence is taking hold in higher education is undeniable, but it is unhelpful to write off all young people simply because of the actions of an entitled minority who wish to go zorbing through life in their bubbles of hot air. I make no secret of my hope that the high priests of the religion of critical social justice will soon lose their collective stranglehold on our media, our arts, and our major educational, political, and law enforcement institutions. I yearn for the day when their more hysterical grievances will be treated with the insouciance they deserve, and that their seemingly interminable culture war will draw to a close. But in a time of such uncertainty, when so many are feeling browbeaten into silence, we have to find a way to reinstate the importance of dialogue. To stand up to these New Puritans, we need to understand where they have come from, what it is they hope to achieve, and where we go from here.